Hello and welcome to Displaced on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Grant Gordon.
And I'm Ravi Gurumurthy.
And if you are listening to this show, that's because you care about the causes of conflict and how to respond to them. Ravi and I work at the International Rescue Committee, where we design, test, and scale new solutions for humanitarian response. And right now, we're doing something a little different on this podcast and interviewing our family members. Last week, I talked to my sister, Glenna Gordon, who is a badass documentary photographer who captures images of crises and those affected by crises. And this week, we're switching it up and going to the Gurumurthy side of the family arc.
But before we get into that, I just want to say up top that this is our last episode of season two. So thank you so much for listening. You can always get in touch with us on Twitter at Grant M. Gordon and at R. Gurumurthy, and email us too at displaced@rescue.org.
And while you are missing us next week going through just a little bit of withdrawal because we don't have an episode, do consider visiting our page and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts anyways. We'd really appreciate it.
Today I'm talking to my dad, Krishnan Gurumurthy, and we're going to be talking about a journey that he began when he was 9 years old living in Burma in 1942. And it was a 1,500-mile journey during the Second World War when he was fleeing the Japanese invasion of Burma, going back to his ancestral home in India. And it was a really dramatic situation because he tried to get on the ferries to go over to India, but the last ferries were all shut and they couldn't get on. And they ended up having to go through a very treacherous land route. And that land route was a 1,500-mile journey, and it took over 42 days. And this exodus, which affected hundreds of thousands of people, is very undercovered. There's very few published accounts of that exodus, and those that are mainly by Europeans. We get into the details of the journey, but it might just be useful to get a sense of the scope of it. The first step of it, from a place called Tongu, which is where Dad started off, was by car, and he took that to the foot of the Irrawaddy River. He then gets on a boat. It was a flat-bottom boat without an engine that went up 150 miles, took about 10 days, and he gets to the foothills of the mountains, the Naga Hills. And that journey is the one that was really, really arduous. It was about 100 miles to get from the Irrawaddy River to the foothills of the Naga Hills, and then another 60 miles to climb over the mountains, and it took a week to do that. So after Dad arrives in India, the journey doesn't end. He ends up having to go to Calcutta and then to Madras. And now I'm going to talk to him about that journey, which happened over 75 years ago. And we're going to be discussing not only that, but also his life afterwards. Dad is now 85 years old, and he's still working full-time in the National Health Service. And we're going to be reflecting on what it takes to succeed if you're a displaced person. So here is the conversation with Dad, or Krishnan Gurumurthy, as I suppose I should introduce him as. So, Dad, thank you for coming on this podcast. I know you've listened to a few shows. So what we're going to try and do today is just talk about your life. It's funny for me even just talking to you about this because it's a story that I've heard told many times by you, but always the details feel sometimes fuzzy. And part of that is because we're going to be talking about things that happened quite a long time ago, 1942, during the Second World War, when you were a 9-year-old boy and you were leaving Burma on a very long journey over back towards the ancestral home in Madras. And it's what's interesting for me is that it's a very untold story generally about the Second World War. I did a history degree, and despite that, and despite learning about the Second World War many, many times at secondary school, I never once heard about the Japanese invasion of Burma and the fact that the British basically got vanquished and lost very badly. And it was only actually relatively recently that I discovered that over 200,000 people left Burma during the Second World War when the Japanese invaded. So, I mean, can you just start off by saying what were you doing in Burma in the first place? Because your family isn't Burmese.
My grandfather migrated to Burma, and my father was born in Mandalay, and I was born in a place called Molmain, also in Burma. And my father worked for the Burmese railways, like most Indians did. And we had a reasonably comfortable life, and most unexpectedly, the war occurred. And what is surprising was Burma, and indeed the British government, was least prepared for the invasion by the Japanese into Burma.
Can you remember the final moments you were in Rangoon?
Yes, I do, because we went to Rangoon to find a place in the boat to leave for India. So we got the tickets, but day after day, we used to reach the harbor only to be turned out because priority was given to the, what are called, Eurasians. And we were...
Those are people who had mixed heritage.
Yes. And also, we were a large family because I had six siblings and we had my grandmother with us. So there was about 10 of us. So to find a place in a boat for 10... as opposed to two or three, it was a bit difficult.
You said grandmother there, but it's actually a really interesting story in that it's actually your wife's mother how come she was part of that mix?
Because it goes back to the fact that my grandfather, that is my father's father, and your grandmother's father were brothers. So, I married my second cousin, as it were, which is a very common thing to do in South India, particularly.
So, the first part of the journey was to the border of India in the north. Yes. You were travelling from sort of three quarters of the way down the country, is that right?
Yes.
Where you came from. That first part of the journey, was that on boat and car, or how much did you walk of that?
Well, we were given a car, we traveled about 100 miles where it was a meeting point. And there it was near the river, called Irrawaddy River. So, Irrawaddy River runs along the north-south of Burma. So we took a boat and we traveled nearly for 10 days along the river. And that was, looking back, we traveled all day long and we stopped in the evening. And the place where we stopped, we were given the rations and there were plants and fruits.
Yeah, you were 9 years old at this time.
Yes.
So after you get to the end of that bit of the journey on the Irrawaddy River by boat, you've still got some way to get to the border.
Yes, we got to a place called Tamu. So there we waited and we travelled as a group, in fact. So our whole journey took nearly 42 days. But the journey in time itself was less than half. The waiting time took more. At every camp place, we had to wait for the next journey to begin, either for the transport to arrange or to get sufficient people to form a group.
And why did you have to travel as a group of 5,000 altogether?
I think the safety in numbers, basically, because especially over the hills, there were animals, wild animals, tigers, and there's a menace of the Burmese pythons, huge snakes. They just swallowed you up. And of course, some of the Naga tribes were not particularly friendly either. And also it was easier for the organizers to supply us with most essentials like rice, dal, and salt.
And the organizers, were they army people?
Yeah, the army, yeah, the British army, yes.
And so this journey, this bit of the journey was about, 100 miles or so over the Naga Hills?
Yeah, that took a week almost because we used to walk from morning to the evening. And that was an ordeal which I still remember, in fact. And I was 9 and by the time I walked a few miles, I used to be very tired. I couldn't even lift my foot sometimes, hit the stones. And I remember asking my dad, look, how long we had to go? And he would just point out at a lamp, or at a light at a far distance and say, look, once we reach there, we arrived. But that light, which happened to be a star, was receding forever. So we never reached. But it kind of pacified us, maybe. It gave us some feeling that maybe we're going to reach the end soon.
I love the fact that the usual story you tell your children that it's just around the corner is still used.
Yes. My father, with 7 children, I don't know how he felt, how he managed. The ordeal must have been quite heavy on him, see. But he somehow seemed to have kept his wits about and very practical and made sure that all of us were safe. Almost unique family in the sense, 10 of us arrived in India. None of them dying, because almost every family lost a member on the way out, especially on the hills.
Can you remember seeing people?
Absolutely, dead bodies by the side, people dying, and people just abandoning them. Some of them were wearing gold and silver jewellery, but those didn't matter at the time. See? They just left and walked on.
But how did, because there were 10 of you, how did mum's grandma get on? Because she must have been pretty old. And you had younger brothers as well who were much younger than you.
See, the three younger ones. See, we had what are called the Manipuri men who offered the services to carry the young ones. Some of them carried even the older people.
Those were just local people who lived there?
Yeah, local people. Very sturdy, strong men. And they, for a fee, they did that. So that's carried us to the mountains, yes.
And that was for your younger...
Three siblings, yes. My grandma, of course, struggled. She walked on. But she was quite a sturdy, even though she was old, she was not particularly frail at the time. So
can you remember getting to... Because where did you arrive in India after that
walk through the hills? After the end of the Rakan Hills, we reached a place called Imphal, which is the capital of Manipur. And that sight still lingers in my mind, actually. The sight as it came down the hill to see the sunshine. And the houses in Imphal were all white buildings. And that was a sight to see, in fact. And at Imphal, again, we congregated and then arranged buses to travel, take us to Assam, which is about 150 miles. And that was a very, very... While walking was difficult, the bus journey was felt worse because it was a journey through the mountains and we all felt sick with that. But we reached a place called Dimapur, which is the end of Assam, British in the Indian Railways.
So that's the very outer eastern edge of the
Assam state, yeah. That is where the railways end or begin, I think it depends.
And was there a sense then of relief that you'd actually made it, or was the...
Yes, indeed. We realize that we don't have to walk anymore, that we'll be, taken by train. And from Dimapur, which is Assam, we came to Calcutta. Then we had to leave Calcutta to come to Madras. That is another, almost 1,000 miles. And that took more than 4 days of slow journey.
Right.
Because it was stopping at almost every major town on the way.
And you were going back to Madras because that was the ancestral home?
Where our family came from. That is, my grandparents, they all supposed to come from a village near Madras. And the funny thing is, neither my grandfather or my father had ever been to the village.
So we're going to take a quick break and we're going to talk a little bit later about what happened when you'd arrived in your home, your new home, Madras, and how you made the most of that.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prof G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So we're back with my dad. I'm on Displaced. Dad, when you arrived in Madras, which was now home, in some ways it wasn't particularly plain sailing then because your father enrolled in the army because that was the only way in which he could make money. This was 1942. And pretty quickly, in the next couple of years, you lost both your mother and your father and you were orphaned. Can you just talk us through what happened when you arrived in Madras and how that next leg unfolded?
The very day when we arrived in Madras, my grandmother fell unconscious. And unfortunately, she passed away the following day. So that was a tragedy which started off, especially for my mother-in-law. You see? So she was the only daughter, and she was waiting for her mother to arrive, and all she could see was her dead body. You see? When we arrived in Madras, we were all shattered, we were exhausted, and we had acquired malaria. And those days, malaria had no specific treatment. But it so happened that a tablet called Polutrin was just discovered and released. And that's what saved all of us.
So that was a tablet?
Tablet, yes. So the house where we arrived was like a hospital bed. We all laid down, see. So it took almost weeks for us to get better from malaria in the first instance. But then my father, faced with the problem, was what's he going to do with his family? Where is he going to live and how is he going to make a living? So he looked around, and the only thing, ironically, was to join the army. So he joined the army, enlisted in the army. So he was a non-combatant, but he was on the administrative side of the army, you see, which meant he had to leave Madras and go back to Chittagong, to the place almost where he came from.
Where is that?
Chittagong is the eastern border of India, or near the Burmese border. In fact, very near where the Japanese were pushing into. Because that's where the 8th Army under Mountbatten was stationed.
So he left in 1942 itself?
Yes, 42 itself. And he used to visit us once a year on holidays. So my mother, meanwhile, had to, we found a place to live, and she looked after us. It so happened that in 45, my mother took a short illness, and she suddenly died. And I was 11, I think. But I wasn't... See, children are not that aware in those days. We didn't know what was going on. I still don't know what was the specific cause of her death. But it was some illness, and she died suddenly. So we were without our mother. So our uncle again took all of us, 7 of us, under his wing. Because under the joint family system of South India, it is his duty to look after us, you see. Then my father was in Chittagong, again caught malaria very badly. So he was discharged on medical grounds from the army in 45. And he was severely ill in the hospital at the time when my mother died. He wasn't even aware that my mother had died. Then when he was discharged, then he came to Madras. And of course, when he came back, he was, I can still remember him. He was a very strong-minded person. And to see him shattered was something which I had not forgotten, in fact. To see his wife died and have his 7 children on his hands again, once again.
So he then passed away quite quickly.
Yeah, so he quickly got a job in the ordnance factory very near Madras. And he also, within 2 weeks of joining the new place, he died suddenly there. And my view is that he had a recrudescence of the malaria, a severe malaria, and malaria can be fatal. And that's what must happen to him.
So you were now 11 or 12?
I was 11, yes.
11 years old.
And 49, 45.
And what's interesting then about the next decades of your life is that you were the one member of the family who ended up going to university.
Yeah.
You were very successful, became a doctor, emigrated. You've now worked in the National Health Service in the UK for over 50 years. You're still working at the age of 85. And the question that we always sometimes ask ourselves in the family is, you know, how did you end up being successful? How did you overcome the odds? Because at that point, as an 11-year-old who was orphaned, living, I think, in one room at one point with all your family, what was it that helped you overcome the odds and be successful? And what's your reflection on the things that proved most important?
I think the single most important influence on our whole family, our brothers, is my eldest brother. He was 15 when my parents died. He had hopes of going to university, but that was shattered. So he went to work. At the age of 18, the legal age, he took charge of all his siblings. He gathered all of us. So we hired this small one-room flat. But he worked very hard. He doubled his income by working both day and night to look after us, because education was not free, even in India. But he was very, very single-minded that we all should be educated. And he was a great guiding force for the entire family, in fact. He made sure that all of us went to school. He was a very light-touch guardian. He never questioned what we did, but as long as... But we found that he motivated us to read. He was very interested in English literature himself. We often used to discuss about Macaulay, Burke, Shakespeare, and Oscar Wilde. And that, of course, gave us an impetus that to study, to learn. So we did very well at school on that basis. And my elder brother was also hoping to go to university. But because I was intent to do medicine, he had to give up his ambition. And so he went to work. And that supported me to enter the medical college. I was pretty single-minded about that. They all were very proud that I got to university, that I became a doctor.
So I did a TED Talk, I think, last year, which was trying to think about what do refugees need when they are displaced. And although it tried to draw on some evidence, it also used your story in a way, because I think you said that the things that really made the difference were, firstly, your extended family, but also other friends that you had. Yeah. You managed to fall into company with people who actually extended your horizons and provided you with opportunities. So one is that sense of network, which often when refugees arrive in a given place, they don't have. Resettlement agencies often don't really focus on helping them connect into different networks. The second thing was education, where you actually went to, I think, the best school in Madras, and that really was a huge help. And the third thing was a little bit of money that your family was able to earn, which they then used for your education. And again, the reason why that's interesting is that often we are quite paternalistic with the way we treat refugees. We provide them with food and shelter and stuff. We don't tend to prioritise education. We don't prioritise social networks. So I think it is quite interesting and instructive about why and how you managed to do well, because it's actually quite at odds with how we tend to provide services to refugees.
In a way, you see, I always feel that, I think I mentioned this, life is full of opportunities. The trick or the genius is to find the opportunity in every situation. We are not pessimistic about our experience. We never dwelt on the fact that we had to come away from Burma. We're always happy together, discussing, always literature, politics, and that sort of thing. We never got into the family squabbles, any of those ideas. And we were a close-knit brothers, in fact, is supporting each other, intellectually, that is. And also, the sense of freedom. My elder brother was only 4 years older than me. But yet, he had the foresight not to be heavy-handed or strong-minded. He gave us infinite freedom to make our own mistakes. I mean, for instance, as I joined university, medical college, one of the fashionable things all medical students do is start smoking, which I could hardly afford a cigarette, but still I took to smoking. And I remember once coming home and some of the little boys had seen me smoking outside and went and sneaked to my elder brother, look, we saw him smoking. You see, my brother said, if I asked him, he'd start smoking in front of me. Actually, he doesn't smoke in front of me now, you see. Because in India, smoking and drinking in front of elders is not the done thing, you see. So, I mean, that was his practical wisdom, sensible and stuff. Otherwise, the emphasis was always on education. I said, nothing else. He must study well and good marks, get to university, and that will see its way.
So we're going to fast forward about 60 years.
Yeah.
And if you take your situation now, you've lived in the UK since 1962.
Indeed, yes.
I think there are sort of a few things to explore here. One is the fact that your memory of this whole period is somewhat blurred sometimes, you've said, and it's partly because you never really dwelt on it. Yeah. And you said that you never really talked to your brothers that much. Why do you think that is?
I can't answer that because I do not know why I didn't do some things. It was not a conscious decision. It's just that we did not ever, it was a fact of life. It happened. There's nothing that we can do about it. my favorite saying, my brother always said, was, what can't be cured must be endured, you'll say.
There is a sort of balance to be struck between recognizing your own past and remembering it, but also being able to move on and not dwell on it too much.
Because at the time when you're moving on, you don't want to think of the past. You're more concentrated in the here and now. And that's what we did. You know, I came to UK and on my own, I knew no anybody here. So it was quite a struggle. It's another struggle again to establish myself and to progress. So we're not going to think of something which happened years ago, you see, because it is of no great use. And it's more important to worry about what is the present. And that's what kept us going, you see. And of course, the NHS, after the initial struggle, I had no problems afterwards. For 50 years, I had an excellent career in NHS, you see. A very safe, assured career, in fact. I did reasonably well there.
You know, you very nearly came, we're recording this in New York, and you very nearly came to America. And probably one of the reasons why you didn't was because you married my mum when she was 17 years old. And part of the condition that her dad put on you marrying her was to actually, I think, come to the UK rather than the US. And this was a love marriage across castes. Yeah. So it was very controversial at the time. But you've always slightly regretted, I think, not being in America. And you come to America and see me and have very rose-tinted spectacles about how wonderful America is. And but you still feel that very strongly, don't you?
It is this ghost of opportunity in life, actually. And America is the maximum opportunity, I feel. I may be wrong, but it seems it's a vast country, a great potential. And I've been to Ellis Island. And I saw, this is what was writ large on all those faces. They left all the privations and problems at home, came to the land of free.
But I think it's it's less about opportunity, because you can have opportunity anywhere, and you could very well argue that you've got more opportunity in the UK, particularly if you don't have much money from through their education system. But I think the more interesting point you sometimes make is about feeling at ease and feeling part of a place. And you've always said that despite doing really, really well in the UK, a bit of you doesn't really feel at home in it. Yes. You've always felt a little bit like an immigrant. And yet you always said that people you knew who went to America didn't feel that. They felt at home. And do you still feel that that is a distinction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is not really unique to me. There are many, many first generation immigrants in the UK who lived there 50 years. They still feel immigrants than part of the country, even though we are UK citizens. We do not have the sense of citizenship. Whereas, see, all my brother's children, it so happened, they're all living in the UK, in the United States. So I can do a sort of a nieces and nephews trip through the United States, right from Detroit to California. They're all places, various places. And they're all, as far as I can see, doing well. And what strikes me about them is a great confidence and sense of assurance that they have about themselves. And that, I feel, comes from this place.
But the legacy of... the other thing I think is interesting is you've never been back to Burma, and you don't really have much curiosity to go back to
Not
Burma.
Not at all, no. I left the country, that's it.
And you also, although you said that you don't necessarily feel at ease in the UK, you don't particularly feel at ease in India either. You like it, you have a deep ambivalence towards it in terms of you loving the music and the culture, but you also don't necessarily like to stay there too long.
You see, I think the two things there. One is when I was student when I was 13, 14, one of the great essays I used to read is Oliver Goldsmith. Yeah, he signed himself the citizen of the world. The concept of citizen of the world was, to me, was very appealing. I have no national allegiance as such. But also, maybe I'm a kind of a gypsy. See, after gypsies came from India. Mm-hmm. So maybe the bit of a gypsy there is in me that I like to keep moving on. So it's partly that as well, you see.
So, and I think the other thing that's probably still a legacy of the whole trip, the journey, was a deep work ethic and a sense of insecurity. So you're still working as a consultant radiologist at 85, nearly, and you have an incredible work ethic that all of us admire. How Do you think that's because of that sense of insecurity you felt growing up being an orphan?
I'm not sure it was a work ethic or a desire for money, you see. I like earning money, and as you know, mom likes spending money, so it'd be well suited there. No, it is also,
it's more than that. You feel you've always felt insecure.
Indeed,
about
absolutely.
Materially insecure.
The day, as long as I'm working, I feel secure and I feel happy in fact. The day I don't work, I don't feel happy, which is very true. So, I mean, even as you know, I'm still working virtually 7 days a week in UK because it so happened the NHS allows you to work as long as you fit and well and compos mentis. That you can carry on working. And as a radiologist, which is very much a sedentary job, it's easy to do that. I couldn't do it if I was a surgeon or an obstetrician.
We were at the comedy cellar last night, and there was a joke by a comedian about how these days doctors are really young. They look like Doogie Howser and they're 12-year-olds. And I was looking at you thinking, well, it's better the 12-year-old than an 85-year-old. So, Dad, thank you very much for being on Displaced. I don't know whether there's anything else we want to say.
Well, you mentioned about memory, you see. Now, whatever I say, I must make it very clear, it's not, I can't swear it's absolutely true. Because it's colored by recollection, colored by modification of experience, you see. So much of it is true. Basically, substantially is very true, in fact. But on the whole, when I look back on my life, if I regret anything, the only thing I regret is not making use of all the opportunities that life has given me, which I could have done better. For instance, I would love to be a very successful academic radiologist instead of being a jobbing radiologist. You see? And that is purely because of my own failure, but no other reason. You see? I didn't apply myself to it. You see? But that's where life goes, you see.
That was Ravi's dad. Ravi, how'd you feel about talking with your dad?
It was lovely talking to Dad. And there's something really interesting about doing this in this artificial environment because you actually are forced to crystallize things in a different way. And also you explore things that you didn't expect to explore, which was great. I love the ending of that interview because it sort of made me laugh that Dad thinks of himself as a failure despite growing up being orphaned and managing to become a successful consultant radiologist and bringing up a very successful family. And it just reminds me about how driven Dad has always been and that insecurity that he faced in childhood, that adversity has been actually an incredible positive thing in many ways, given his work ethic and drive. And I've had a long conversation with Dad over many, many years about poverty and injustice. And Dad used to say to me in the UK, there is no such thing as poverty because people don't realise how bad it could be given his own upbringing. And this was, as you can imagine, a long argument. But what it does bring home to me, my dad's story, is that things that are not tangible, like having aspirations, having drive, having social networks, role models, having a disposition that's very gritty and persistent, all of those things are so key to overcoming the odds. And yet in many of our programming, we don't really think seriously about that cultural capital, that social capital, and how we build it. The other thing that I think about a bit about is about memory. And there's this lovely quote from Viet Tan Nguyen, who we interviewed last season, mm-hmm. about memory. And he said that, I do not remember many things. And for all those things I do not remember, I'm grateful. And I think there's something quite interesting about the extent to which you leave behind your past in order to not be trapped by it, but also paying enough heed to it to actually cherish those thoughts and appreciate it properly. And I think it's something that I wrestle with, particularly as I bring up children and try and give them a sense of where they've come from.
It makes me think that a lot of this season and a lot of the podcast in general are dealing with kind of concrete operational tactical issues of what happens during crises, how you respond to them, how to think about the politics of these times. But a major large theme is, what are the narratives that we construct around them? What are the stories we tell ourselves? What are the stories that are told about them? A lot of what I think we're doing on this podcast sometimes may come off as looking under the hood of, you know, bureaucracies and politics in humanitarian response and kind of trying to pierce through it. But a lot of that also is taking more seriously what the narratives around humanitarian response and humanitarian politics are and diving into depth in them in a way that I think often doesn't happen.
I feel like the lesson of this is that everybody should have like structured interviews with their family members.
Yeah, I agree.
This is the last episode of season two, but just because it's the last episode of this season doesn't mean we want to stop the conversation or not hear from you anymore. Feel free to check out our old episodes and other seasons at www.rescue.org/displaced or on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And we do want to hear from you. Feel free to tweet at us. I'm at Grant M. Gordon. And Ravi's, what is his Twitter handle?
At Argramurthy. A big thanks to lots of people at Vox Media. Displaced is produced by Megan Cunane. Our engineer is Jelani Carter with extra help from Jarrett Floyd. And it would be cruel not to take the piss out of Golda Arthur one last time. Grant, do your worst.
That was the silent treatment, Golda. That was what that was. Andershot Kerwa is our executive producer of audio. A huge thank you to Women Audio Mission here in San Francisco, where I am taping, at the International Rescue Committee. Anna Fuhrer is our researcher, and a special thanks to Alex Bandea, Natalie Sarkowski, and Ben Moskowitz. Thank you for listening this season, and we will see you down the road.
Thank you for listening, everybody. See you soon.